almost ended up in Yellowknife at some point. So if there are any complaints about the quality of this talk, please direct them to United's customer service. So the show must go on regardless, and I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing with Thomas Hartog and Gary Horowitz. And this is going to be based partly on a paper that appeared in PRL this fall, and partly on a paper that should appear in the archive in the next few weeks. So the title, the subject, is Big Bang Singularities in Holography. I don't think I really need to motivate why we might want to understand Big Bang Singularities. If we ever really hope to have a good understanding of how our own universe came to be, we will have to confront the thorny issue of what Big Bang Singularities really are. And to do so, we need a non-perturbative formulation of quantum gravity, which unfortunately we don't have, or fortunately, because it means we all still have jobs. So this is where holography comes in. Holography gives us not a direct formulation of non-perturbative quantum gravity, but an indirect one. It tells us that string theory on an asymptotically ADS geometry background is in every way, or can in every way, be described by the dynamics of a quantum field theory that lives on the conformal boundary. So while this is not a direct formulation of non-perturbative quantum gravity, it does give us a way of asking questions about non-perturbative quantum gravity and translating them into the language of quantum field theory. And so it's very tempting and appealing to ask the question of, can we understand Big Bang singularities by translating them from non-perturbative quantum gravity via holography to the language of quantum field theory? And that is going to be the subject of my talk today. So the idea is, we really want to understand how is a classical singularity in the classical gravity limit of string theory, modified when we add strong quantum and stringy effects. In other words, we want to understand how this arrow here works. And again, in order to do that, we need some non-perturbative quantum gravity, which we don't have. But using ADS-CFT, we can sort of go the long way around. We can first translate a classical singularity into something in a strongly coupled field theory with a large number of colors. And then by sort of tweaking these parameters, we can arrive at a weakly coupled conformal field theory, small n, which is then dual to a quantum stringy cosmology with some form of singularity, whatever that is, in non-perturbative quantum gravity. So this is what I will be attempting to do today. More concretely, the idea is to take the near singularity physics and to really understand how that's encoded in the behavior of some field theory observable. And then to understand how that behavior is modified when we go from this regime to this regime, because that's really, by ADS-CFT, the same thing as going from this regime to this regime. So more concretely, again, I want to understand how an observable in the field theory encodes information about the singularity. And the observable that we used was the equal time two-point correlator of a scalar operator of large conformal dimension. The reason that we use this is twofold. First, two-point correlators are one of the easier things to calculate in field theory. And second, that the classical gravity dual is very simple. It's just the length of space-like bulk GUD6. And if we're going to do this translation, we really need to start with the classical singularity. So this is the general idea. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I plan to do this in more detail. So we start out on the classical gravity side. And we need a very special kind of geometry in order to execute this translation mechanism. We need something that's asymptotically ADS and has a Big Bang singularity. If we don't have a Big Bang singularity, we're not asking questions about Big Bang singularities. We also need the conformal boundary to be singularity free. And the reason is that if the field theory lives on a spacetime that has a curvature singularity, then we're not really translating the question of a curvature singularity into field theory language, because the curvature singularity sits on both sides of the equation. So we want to be able to translate it into a problem that's free of singularities. And that's why this number two is so important. And finally, since we're using the two-point correlator, it would be really good to know that the GUD6 actually do reach the near singularity region, so that we can be sure that the two-point correlator is, in fact, sensitive to near singularity physics. And so the bulk of my talk will be spent, well, maybe half my talk will be spent on sort of building this kind of cosmology that obeys all of these three properties. And then we want to compute the two-point function in the strongly coupled field theory and identify exactly how the singularity, the bulk classical singularity, is encoded in this two-point correlator. This is the translation of the classical singularity into field theory language. Then we want to lower the coupling and n to get to understand how the signature is modified when the two-point correlator is telling us something about the quantum stringy singularity. So that's the general idea. And again, I'll first talk about building this cosmology. Then I'll talk about what the two-point correlator sees. And it turns out to be quite dramatic, an interpretation of that in the weakly coupled field theory, and lots of open questions, because there is a lot of work to be done on this. So start out with building a cosmology. Let me just reiterate, we want something which is asymptotically ADS, has a Big Bang singularity, solves Einstein's equations, conformal boundary metric, has no curvature singularity, and space-like boundary-anchored bulk UD6 see very close to the singularity. They reach the high curvature regions. So we can say that the two-point correlator is sensitive to near-singularity physics. So let me start just by putting forward some things about pure ADS, which turns out to be very useful. So we can write pure ADS in many different kinds of coordinate systems. There's global AES, which has, as a conformal boundary, the Einstein static universe. There's the Poincaré patch. Z here is the bulk coordinate, which is 0 on the boundary. And the constant Z slices are just Minkowski space. And finally, we have this one, which is perhaps not as famous or as familiar to most people, which is the slicing of global ADS into De Sitter and FRW patches. And that's what I've drawn here. This one is often used in holographic cosmology. And the idea is that here we have some open FRW geometry here and here. And excuse me, the light cone here is a null coordinate singularity. It comes about because sine squared t vanishes there. This is the metric in the open FRW universe in here. And we slice the exterior region into De Sitter slices. Now, I want to spend a minute or two talking about the choice of conformal boundary for this, because it turns out to be very important later on. So we have freedom in the choice of conformal boundary when we do ADS CFT, because we have a CFT, so we can conformally rescale. Now, we always have to make sure that the conformal boundary is conformal to some patch of the Einstein static universe. If we're working in global coordinates, it has to be conformal to the entire Einstein static universe. But we can pick a coordinate patch so it's conformal to only part of it. So for example, if we choose to work in Poincaré coordinates, then we can pick our conformal boundary to be conformal to Minkowski space. Or if we work in this the Sitter slicing with FRW universes, the conformal boundary is De Sitter, and we can take something which is conformally equivalent to De Sitter. So the reason I'm telling you all of this is because it will later turn out to be very important that we have this freedom in choosing what the conformal boundary is. But for now, let's just go with De Sitter, because FRW sounds really, really promising if we're trying to build a cosmology. And there is indeed, there have been a number of constructions of an isotropic ADS cosmology using this these FRW De Sitter slicings. So the idea is to couple ADS to a scalar field, backreacted on the geometry. And now what we before had, this sinh squared here and a sine squared here, these have changed. And they change based on the profile of the scalar field, so that now we actually have a curvature singularity in the bulk. I'll show you a conformal diagram in a second. Now, the dual field theory still lives on De Sitter space. So the dual field theory is actually still living on space-time, which is singularity-free. And our scale factor still vanishes on the light cone and also vanishes at the singularity. So just to illustrate this, let me show you a conformal diagram. So here's what happened. The space-time got cut off here at these curvature singularities, where before we had multiple open FRW universes. These were null, and now they've turned into something space-like. And again, the curvature singularity has a vanishing scale factor, as does the light cone here. And the conformal boundary is, again, De Sitter. So it looks like we've done pretty well. That's two of the requirements that we wanted It has space-like singularity in the bulk, a Big Bang, and a Big Crunch, even though I only really required one of them. And it also has the Sitter boundary, which means the field theory is singularity-free. So that's 2 out of 3. Do bulk space-like GD6 reach very close to the singularity in the high curvature region here? That's the third requirement. And it turns out the answer is actually no. Back in 2013, Aaron Wall and I proved a theorem on the reach of extremal surfaces in any space-time that has a boundary, not just ADS. And the reason that this is relevant is because GD6 extrema is the length functional, so they are extremal surfaces as well. Now, the theorem states that if we have a space-time with a boundary, like ADS, anything which is asymptotically ADS, and this space-time has a codimension 1 surface which splits the space-time into 2 regions. So here I've drawn sigma is the surface, and here's the exterior of sigma, that's one region, and the interior of sigma is the other region. Now the exterior and the interior have to be connected, so we really only have 2 connected regions. And the union of the exterior of sigma with sigma and the interior of sigma is the entire space-time. If sigma has non-positive extrinsic curvature as a form, which means that the normals to sigma converge outside of sigma, as shown here, where by outside I mean in the exterior, then no space-like extremal surface, which is anchored outside of sigma, can ever cross sigma. And there are some smoothness assumptions which I haven't stated for simplicity, but there are some assumptions implicit in here. So here is an extremal surface. It's anchored in the exterior of sigma on the boundary. And it doesn't matter how we pick the boundary conditions, we can never get it to cross the interior of sigma. This may not sound like a problem. You could say, well, we could just anchor it right there. So why are we worrying about this? Well, we might worry about this if the interior of sigma has no intersection at all with the boundary. For example, if sigma is compact, then we can't anchor surfaces to the boundary and also to its interior. And so its interior is a region which is entirely invisible to extremal surfaces. You could say, well, why don't we perturb the space-time a little bit and get rid of this this barrier surface? But for barriers that have negative extrinsic curvature, that's going to be stable under small perturbations. You're going to need a larger perturbation to turn it positive. And finally, these things happen actually quite a bit. Stationary black hole horizons, for example, are extremal surface barriers. And the reason, of course, that I quote this theorem is because this isotropic cosmology also has an extremal surface barrier. I've only drawn one at the top there to prevent clutter, but there's also one right here on the bottom. So if we look at constant T slices within the open FRW universe, the extrinsic curvature of those slices is given by this equation. This is a derivative of the scale factor. Now recall that the scale factor vanishes both on the light cone and at the singularity, which means that there is a surface where the derivative of the scale factor vanishes. So the extrinsic curvature vanishes there, and that is an extremal surface barrier, which means that GD6 that are anchored anywhere on the boundary can never see past this region. And unfortunately, this just happens to be the high curvature region. So you could say, well, that's vanishing extrinsic curvature. Can't we perturb it a little bit? That's not negative. Well, it turns out that every constant time slice to its future has progressively more negative extrinsic curvature. And so small perturbations are not going to get rid of this barrier surface. And we're kind of stuck. And the solution to this, here we are, we're stuck. We don't have this. And so how do we fix this? And the solution is to take a very large perturbation, to introduce a very large amount of anisotropy, which breaks the barrier. It gets rid of the barrier altogether. And this doesn't sound very nice. I don't know if there are any cosmologists in the room, but if there are, they're probably very upset with me right now, because our universe is not anisotropic. And we really should be trying to model something isotropic. And the reason that I'm actually OK with this, I think it's OK to talk about anisotropy in this context, is that we're trying to understand a region of very small volume and very large curvature. And whether that region expands equally in all directions or not is not as relevant as what is really going on with this infinite curvature. It's not the same thing, but by gaining intuition about the anisotropic singularities, we will understand a lot about how quantum gravity treats singularities, and we'll be able to make statements about isotropic singularities, hopefully, as well. So I'm going to pursue with the anisotropy. In flat space, we have a very nice homogeneous vacuum anisotropic solution to Einstein's equations. It looks like this. It's called the Kasner solution. It's got a Big Bang singularity at t equal to 0. And there's a different scale factor in front of each one of the different directions, where the scale factor is just a power law. And in order to satisfy Einstein's equations, it has to satisfy these constraints, these exponents called the Kasner exponents. And this, altogether, this with these equations, it satisfies Einstein's equations. Now, there is a d minus 2 parameter family of solutions in d plus 1 dimensions. And one of these exponents is always going to be negative, except in a very special case where one of the exponents is exactly 1, and then you can immediately read off from these that the rest of them have to vanish. That's just the Milne universe, actually. And the curvature and the singularity is just a coordinate singularity. It's not a curvature singularity. This is just Minkowski space in funny coordinates. And so we don't really want to think about this issue. So we're going to always think about the case where one exponent is negative. In other words, there is a curvature, a genuine curvature singularity in the Kasner universe whenever one exponent, if and only if, one of the Kasner exponents is negative. So this is all very nice, especially because it's homogeneous. But this is flat, and we want something which is asymptotically ADS. There is a neat trick for getting ADS, ADS geometries out of flat geometries. If we just start out with the usual Poincaré patch metric, which I had written earlier, this is the conformal diagram. We have this time-like boundary at z equal to 0, and the z equals constant slices are Minkowski slices. If we just replace these Minkowski slices by any metric, any geometry, which solves the Einstein equations, is Ricci flat, then we'll get a new asymptotically ADS geometry, which also solves Einstein's equations. And so this is precisely what I'm doing here. I'm replacing the eta mu nu dx mu dx nu here by this Kasner metric, which solves the Einstein equations. And that gives me a new geometry where the z constant slices are just Kasner universes. And because the Kasner universes all have a singularity at t equal to 0, so does the bulk now. So that's all very nice. We have broken some symmetries. I've broken the isotropy. But there's actually a non-trivial killing symmetry, which is not obvious from this metric here. It's sort of like a warped dilation. It rescales the time coordinate, and it rescales this bulk coordinate, and also funnily rescales the other coordinates. And it acts on surfaces of constant z over t. This will turn out to be useful in just a couple of slides, so keep it in mind. And of course, the singularity is a fixed point of this isometry. We don't, none of the points here can be mapped to the singularity. Yeah?
There were two questions on your previous slide.
Yeah.
The thing that was the horizon is now a singularity as well.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so this becomes a null singularity here. And the reason that I'm actually not going to worry about that is that I'm going to work in the regime where things are sort of down here, and none of my extremal surfaces will reach even close to the null singularities. And so one way to get rid of it is to say, take a late slice here, something close to this thing, and then set the Kasner exponents to all be equal, or evolve them so that they're all equal. So we sort of make them time dependent on some small region here, so that they become all equal by the time that you reach the Poincaré horizon, and that makes it regular.
Right. The other question was just about philosophy. At one point, you mm-hmm. didn't want to have a singularity on the boundary.
That's right.
But aren't we stuck with a singularity?
Good point. Hold on to that for a second. Okay. Yeah. I'll address that in just a minute. Actually, I'll address it now. So yes, if we pick the usual conformal factor of 1 over z, we're left with a boundary which is just flat Kasner. And flat Kasner, as we know, has the Big Bang singularity at t equal to 0. And that's what I didn't want. So it sounds like I sacrificed the no singularity on the boundary for geodesics reaching close to the singularity. But instead, I'm just not going to pick the conformal factor of 1 over z. I'm going to pick a new conformal factor of t over z. Now, recall that I made this big deal about how we have this freedom to pick any conformal factor we really want, as long as it's conformally equivalent to the boundary. And this is indeed conformally equivalent to the Kasner universe. We've just fixed this new conformal factor. And with this conformal factor, the conformal field theory lives on sort of an anisotropic version of the Sitter space in its deflationary stage. So the idea is that the Hubble parameters in each direction are different. But other than that, it looks like the Sitter in flat slicing. And the nice thing is that the singularity has been pushed to past infinity. So this is geodesically complete. And I guess at a point of notation, I've changed the coordinates here. This is now the proper time on the boundary. So tau is negative log t, where t is the time coordinate in the bulk. So this is great. This is geodesically complete. And the boundary space-time is now regular. We have a Big Bang singularity in the bulk. And we don't have an extremal surface barrier. What's even nicer about this is because I used a conformal factor, which doesn't change under the bulk isometry, the boundary field theory, the boundary metric, has inherited the bulk isometry. And so we have this nice time translation and sort of length contraction or expansion symmetry, which allows us to do something very nice. Instead of calculating the two-point correlator on some arbitrary time slice at arbitrary separation, this symmetry tells me, this here, tells me that I can just calculate it on one time slice and at arbitrary separation. And I can map that with the symmetry to a two-point correlator on any other time slice. And so I'm going to fix the very convenient time slice of tau is equal to 0 or t equal to 1 and just compute the two-point correlator at any separation on that time slice. And by this isometry, that will be equivalent, that will be equal to a two-point correlator on any other time slice. So as I said before, we have all the checklists for the kind of geometry that I said we needed. And now, finally, we're ready to move on to the interesting part, which is what the two-point correlator is. And I guess the title of this section gives it away. There is drama. So how do we compute a two-point correlator from GeoD6? Well, in the semi-classical limit, there's a saddle point approximation we can use. We have some operator O, which has high conformal dimension in the CFT, and x and y are points on the boundary. And in this limit, where the delta is large and it's semi-classical, this can be computed with this with this equation, the exponential negative delta L reg xy, where L reg is the regulated length of the shortest bulk space-like geodesic that connects the points x and y on the boundary. I don't really want to talk too much about how one regulates it just yet. If people have questions, I have a couple of extra slides prepared on it, but it's not really that relevant, not really that important. Okay, so let me remind you what we set out to do. I'm going to calculate the lengths of these GeoD6 and figure out exactly which ones probe near the singularity, and then understand how the GeoD6 that reach the singularity, the high curvature region, have those affect the two-point correlator. Figure out what is the signature of this near singularity physics on the two-point correlator. So this is the setup. I'm going to, as I said, fix the boundary conditions to be on tau equal to 0 or t equal to 1. So that's this right here. To make everything extra simple, I'm going to allow only separation in one of the spatial directions, and I'll fix the other ones to 0. And to make it even simpler, I'm going to take z2 symmetry on my endpoints. Because I have this translation symmetry in x, it doesn't really matter where I fix my endpoints, but it turns out to be just computationally simple if I fix them to have this z2 symmetry. The reason I've drawn these dashed blue lines is to just denote that I can map this two-point correlator to a later time slice by changing the separation. So computing the two-point correlator here will give me an answer for the two-point correlator here, here, or anywhere else on this dotted blue surface. Now, the two-point correlator can only depend on the proper boundary separation, which is given by this quantity. And because I fixed t0 to be 1, it's just 2x0, where these are the endpoints. So because we have a conformal field theory and we have no special length scales, we can only expect something special to happen due to the singularity at vanishing boundary separation, or when the boundary separation is equal to the cosmological horizon, which is sort of a natural length scale in this problem already. So these are the two places to watch out for. And if we find something at a different length scale, then we know that something went wrong. So I've told you that GD6 reached arbitrarily close to the singularity, but you kind of had to take my word for it. I didn't show you, I didn't prove it. So let me spend some time convincing you that this is actually the case. So the GD6 will propagate in three dimensions: the time direction, the x direction, which is separated along that direction, and the z direction. This is because I have a translation symmetry in the other x directions. So I can, if I take those to be zero on the endpoints, I can take them to be zero everywhere along the GD6. Now the GD6 turn around at x equal to zero because I've imposed Z2 symmetry on the endpoints. And it actually turns out that the GD6 equation for, well, if I parametrize the GD6 in terms of x, the GD6 equation for T of x decouples from the GD6 equation for Z of x, and actually is quite simple. This is what it looks like. Now at the turning point, I require that the GD6 be smooth so that this derivative vanishes. And so at the turning point of the GD6, at its maximal, and it's at the furthest point that it gets, this is what the equation looks like. So it's T double prime of x times T of x plus negative p, T of x to the 2p. When p is negative, the second derivative is positive, which means that there is a minimum along t. And that means that the GD6 start out with a higher value of t than they end up. And so the GD6 actually reach closer to the singularity. They are attracted to the singularity whenever p, which is the Kästner exponent along the x direction, is negative. And in fact, it turns out that these GD6 probe the high curvature region. And all we have left to determine is how they compute, how do they contribute to the two-point correlator. So that means we have to actually solve the GD6 equations. And it turns out you can actually do it for any value of p analytically. It's a horrible set of hypergeometric functions, so I'm not going to put those down. There was a recent paper that computed, I think, some of those, and we'll have it out also in our upcoming paper. But for certain special values of p, when p is equal to negative 1 over 2n, where n is an integer, the hypergeometric functions simplify into just polynomials in a certain parameter. And the simplest example really is when p is equal to negative 1/2. And for that, we need 5 plus 1 bulk dimensions. The reason this is simple is because the other values of Kästner exponents are all equal, and they're equal to positive 1/2. And so the metric looks like this. This is t to the 2p, where p is negative 1/2. And then this is t to the 2p, where p is positive 1/2. And I've written this in this way because I now have three-dimensional subspace that has spherical symmetry in it. The reason this is not important for the GD6 calculation, because GD6 only see T, X, and Z, but it'll turn out to be interesting when we do a field theory analysis. So what does these GD6 actually look like? Well, it's actually simpler to parametrize them in terms of T than in terms of X. So this is what we did, and the solutions are quite simple. This parameter here, C, fixes the proper boundary separation. So this is proper boundary separation. That's what it looks like. Now, C equal to negative 1 corresponds to vanishing boundary separation. So does C equal to positive 1/2, but it turns out that that's not a physical, that's something that we have to exclude, and I'll justify that in a minute. And C equal to 0 corresponds to separation at the cosmological horizon size in the x direction. Now, there are three, this is a cubic equation, there are three values of C for every L boundary. And so there are three GD6 that give us the same separation. The reason is that the GD6 equation is not a well-posed boundary value problem. It's a well-posed initial value problem, but not a well-posed boundary value problem. And so we'll have to figure out which GD6 actually contribute to the two-point correlator and which ones are not physical. So this is what it looks like. This is the boundary separation as a function of the real part of C. And yes, C can be complex. So at any point, we have three values of C. This here corresponds to real values of C, the blue, and up here, these are complex conjugate solutions. So, well, now there are three solutions. We want to be able to exclude at least some of them. Well, it turns out that whenever c is greater than 0, we can exclude those GD6 altogether. And the reason is that GD6 turn around at t equal to negative c. That's where the turning point happens if the GD6 is to be smooth at the turning point. And so when t is greater than 0, these GD6 just crash into the singularity and keep going. And the GD6 approximation breaks down when the spacetime is not analytic. It breaks down at the singularity. And so we can't try to approximate the two-point correlator with GD6, that probe a region at which the approximation just breaks down. But if we try to do that, then we get something very unphysical, which is not surprising. We get a divergence in the two-point correlator as the boundary separation goes to infinity. And that's, of course, completely unphysical. The two-point correlator should be dying off as the separation between the endpoints approaches infinity. And so we say that all of these solutions where c is greater than 0 are not physical, and we just exclude them altogether. This leaves us with two values of c for every value of the horizon of the boundary separation. There is this branch here, which starts out at vanishing boundary separation and goes all the way up here. There's this branch here, which starts out at the horizon size and goes all the way up here. And then we have this complex conjugate pair. Well, it looks like the complex conjugate pair we have to include because we want to be able to set the boundary separation to be, say, 4. We want to be able to talk about boundary separations that are that large. So we have to include this. But there is a degeneracy here where we could maybe include just one branch and not both, and things would still work fine. And in order to see what we have to do, we have to actually calculate the two-point correlator. And this is what it is. So the regulated length of these GD6 is very simple, actually. It's just this logarithm. And we compute the two-point correlator with this formula, and we get this. Let's just stare at this for a minute. Well, at c equal to negative 1, we have a divergence. It's not really surprising. We kind of want that divergence because this divergence corresponds to the short distance separation. And indeed, it goes as 1 over L boundary to the 2 delta, which is the correct divergence at small separation. But there's another divergence at c is equal to 0, which is unexpected. C is equal to 0 is the horizon size, the cosmological horizon size. And so the two-point correlator diverges at the horizon size. Well, where does it come from? GD6 that have c very close to 0 and negative are space-like bulk GD6 that probe very close to the singularity. They probe progressively closer to it and also progressively closer to the boundary. They reach very high curvature regions. And the limiting c equals 0 GD6 is actually a null boundary GD6. And so because these GD6 reach very high curvature regions, this pole that we see in the two-point correlator is directly related to near-singularity physics. And let me show you what it looks like. This is a two-point correlator. This is the short-distance divergence. It dies off. And then we have this other divergence at the cosmological horizon with GD6 from GD6 that see the singularity. So this is a very strong signature of the singularity. And you might say, well, wait a second. Is this actually physical? Should we maybe exclude it? Well, there isn't really a good reason to get rid of it. This pole lies on a causal surface, so we can't use causality constraints to rule it out. The pole divergence is of lower order. You might worry that this pole, in some sense, violates the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality in QFT, but it doesn't, because it's of lower order than the short-distance divergence. And finally, and perhaps most convincingly, if we don't include the pole, we get a discontinuity in the two-point correlator at a random length scale, which definitely shouldn't be happening in a CFT. So if we, say, chose to start out here and then move along this branch and then just continue off to the complex plane here without ever including the pole, GD6 that come from the pole, we would get a discontinuity right here in the two-point correlator. And this is not a physical thing to happen because, as I mentioned earlier, the horizon separation is where we expect something to happen and not anywhere else.
In your cosmologies, there is a scale, right?
In
your cosmologies, there is a scale. So why would you say it's surprising? Why can't the scales that you see is because you have a non-vanishing peak?
What do you say is the scale?
Well, I mean, just if I look at the metric, right? So mm-hmm. I need to, if I want to have units right, I need to introduce some scale there.
Sure, I guess we set everything to 1 in this case. Yeah, we set everything to 1.
You know, quantity. So I'm saying you set it to be equal to 1 and mm-hmm. you get, you know, sort of funny things happens
yes.
at scale before the 1. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe what you see is a discontinuity is reflected towards the appearance of the scale in your background metric when you impose Kastner.
Perhaps. Perhaps there is the fact that this is it is continuous whenever we do include this branch, which is I think a compelling reason to believe that this the discontinuity is not physical, because these two branches are not don't appear to be related. They come from very different geodesics, and yet when we add them up, we get something which is continuous here. So, but I see your point. Okay, so the pole happens actually whenever we have a singularity in the bulk. Whenever we have a p less than 0, a two-point correlator which is separated with a direction where p is less than 0, then there is a pole. You can prove that this always happens. And now remember that Kastner ADS only has a curvature singularity, or has a curvature singularity if and only if one of the Kastner exponents is negative. And so the pole is going to occur if and only if there is a curvature singularity in the bulk. And so we see there is a very strong connection here between the pole and the singularity. It comes from geodesics that are near the singularity, and it only exists when we have a singularity. And so we claim that this is a signature of the singularity. This is how the bulk Big Bang singularity is encoded in the two-point correlator of the dual field theory. And so this is, we identify the signature, check. So what does it mean? That's a little harder. Do these effects come from strong coupling or from large N, or maybe both of them at the same time? Or does this result from some field theory state which only exists at strong coupling? This is certainly an appealing possibility, because this divergence is not something that we're used to seeing at weakly coupled field theory. Unfortunately, the field theory's calculation is actually quite difficult to do. It's very hard to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in anisotropic spacetimes. So rather than sort of try to do this very difficult numerical analysis, especially when everything else here has been analytic, we decided to try to just understand where this behavior might be coming from by transforming the two-point correlator from position space to momentum space, because we have much better intuition about it when it's in momentum space. So what we did was we smeared the two-point correlator out a little bit in the positive p directions, because it's not really physical to have the two-point correlator be separated entirely just in one direction. So we smeared it out just a little bit in the p's greater than 0 directions. And that modulates the pole a little bit. It takes it from being a pole to being just a very, very large, I guess, almost divergence. And when the conformal dimension is 1, which admittedly is not the regime we should be working in, but I'll justify that in a second, then the two-point correlator in momentum space looks like this. These terms, this comes from, this is just the ordinary thing we see in QFT, which comes from integrating all of the momentum, all of the momenta from the short distance divergence. And then we see something funny. So this K1 is the momentum in the p is less than 0 direction. This K is the momentum, the radial momentum along the three-dimensional spherically symmetric subspace. If you recall, in the case of p equals negative 1/2, we had three directions which had the same scale factor. And so we had this three-dimensional spherically symmetric subspace. And that's the momentum in that direction, in the radial direction. Epsilon here is a UV cutoff, which corresponds to a UV cutoff that we used in the bulk to regulate the lengths of geodesics. So what is this term? Well, when you do the calculation, you integrate everything out, you see that this term comes from the horizon separation divergence. This is a direct consequence of the divergence at the horizon separation. And so this is sort of the signature of the singularity in the momentum space correlator. And the reason that this was justified is that all that happens at large delta is that this becomes worse. The logarithm of epsilon becomes a negative power of epsilon. And so this is even stranger in some sense. So what is, keep on saying this is really weird. What is so very weird about this cosine 1L log epsilon behavior? Well, for one, there exist special values of the momenta that the two-point correlator has no dependence on the UV cutoff at all. The UV cutoff dependence just vanishes altogether when we have these momenta, when this K1 momentum is exactly the associated with the horizon separation. And more generally, the UV cutoff sort of oscillates with the momentum. The strength of the UV cutoff goes up and down depending on what the momentum mode is. This really does not seem possible at weak coupling. This has to be a strong coupling effect. And this is really in favor of the conclusion that stringy effects have to do something very drastic to the singularity. And in particular, if we want to view the pole as something very pathological, which is due to the fact that a classical singularity is pathological, it's an end to space time, it has all these infinities, then we might view the regulation of the pole as a sign that string theory resolves the singularity in some nice way. This isn't really shocking. We kind of expect it, but it's nice to see it anyways.
What's the position space counterpart of all these statements?
Sorry, I'm trying to, who was,
What is the position space counterpart of all these statements in momentum space?
So that was the one I talked about earlier. That was the divergence.
There you had omitted epsilon, right? So here you have epsilon.
Oh, so this
epsilon,
right.
When Fourier transforming. Right?
So that the epsilon corresponds to capping off the divergence at some very large but finite amount. So we would just this epsilon is to do with the regulation of how we regulate the lengths of GD6. And actually, since you asked the question, let me just go to that slide that I have.
The permanent position space doesn't seem like something so esoteric. Look like something normal, and then all these effects come from Fourier transforming.
Well, in position space, it's just a way of capping the momentum, but capping the pole. So it is not actually a divergence; it just stops somewhere. So that's all that epsilon corresponds to. I can either sort of tell you how we regulate GD6 now, or I can tell you at the end of the talk. Your choice.
No, I understand. I think I understand the point. The point is that if you go beyond strong coupling, you no longer have geodesics, so you will soften the singularity.
No. So the
integrator of all geodesics will not be a Pascal subtle point, and then
so that's actually not that's not what the epsilon corresponds to. The UV cutoff corresponds to something to a surface. We pick a surface that's close to the boundary, and any length of geodesics which lies in that surface gets subtracted out. And so what happens is the pole is due, the actual infinity is due to a null boundary geodesic. And this null boundary geodesic gets completely removed when we have this epsilon, when we impose a UV cutoff such that a small surface near the boundary is taken out, because that's a boundary geodesic. So it actually doesn't have to do with where they go near the singularities, it's how close they are to the boundary.
So this statement that UV cutoff contribution oscillates with momentum, it looks like a signature that your theory is not renormalizable. So strictly speaking, you haven't removed the, even though you did some magic and you're saying there is no singularity on the boundary, but I think there is still a singularity in the boundary. There is still a Big Bang singularity. So maybe that's sort of what you see is the signature.
A signature that we sort of push the singularity off to past infinity?
It's still there. And when we do a field theory, we are sensitive.
So the field theory, it has to be sensitive to this in some way.
And this is just typically what you would expect and what would happen if your field theory is not renormalized.
I see.
If you put it on the sick space-time.
Although the space-time isn't, strictly speaking, sick, but it's conformally equivalent to a space-time, which is, yes.
It's a naked singularity, so.
Yeah, it is sick. I don't know.
It's not actually geodesically incomplete, but I see your point. This is a conformal field theory, and you can conformally rescale the two-point correlator so that it's living on that other spacetime, which is sick. Yes. Now this is actually relevant to what we were just saying. Since we're talking about the field theory living on Kästner, so we can just take our field theory on the anisotropic de Sitter and we conformally rescale it so it's living on Kästner, it's actually interesting to think about this from the perspective of boundary conformal field theory. So we can think of the t equals zero singularity as a boundary to space-time, and the field theory is n equals four superiang mils, so it is a conformal field theory. And so we have a, excuse me, a conformal field theory with a boundary. And so it's natural to think about this in terms of boundary conformal field theory. And this is, I guess, where one would say it sees the singularity, the conformal field theory sees the singularity on the boundary. Because we could imagine putting Dirichlet boundary conditions on this singularity at t equal to 0. And in 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory, 1 plus 1 dimensional boundary conformal field theory, one way to calculate the two-point correlator is to, when we have these Dirichlet boundary conditions, is to use the method of images. And so we start out with the two points close to one another, and they sort of, they don't see the boundary. And we take them further and further apart. And at the horizon separation, they're going to lie on the light cone. And so they're going to have light cone singularities, which looks a lot like what we were seeing. And then you take them, you separate them further out more, and the two-point correlator dies out. And so there's a question of whether we can actually model the this whole thing in terms of the Dirichlet boundary conditions at the Kasner singularity. And then what happens if we change the bulk space-time? Is it the Dirichlet boundary conditions that change into something which is sort of softer, or smoother, or is it just not boundary conditions? And, yeah.
What do you mean with Dirichlet?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean with Dirichlet? Do you just mean boundary conditions? Do you mean specific?
So, sorry, could you...
What do you mean with Dirichlet? Dirichlet is opposed to Neumann? Or?
Oh, if, for example, I mean, it could change. I don't know what it could change into, but yeah, if we take Dirichlet boundary conditions here in the classical case, and then we presumably the bulk state is very different when you have quantum string, we have strong quantum stringy effects. And so if classical gravity is going to be dual to Dirichlet boundary conditions, I would assume that a quantum stringy bulk would be dual to something very different. The state of the field theory would be different. And if the Dirichlet boundary conditions here are what determines the state of the field theory, then I would expect that they would change in some way.
So when you say Dirichlet, you mean Dirichlet in gravity or Dirichlet?
I'm sorry?
When you say Dirichlet, you mean Dirichlet in the gravity theory or Dirichlet in gravity?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
For which?
Which field?
For which field?
So it would be on this. So the Dirichlet boundary conditions would be on the scalar field, the scalar this we have, because I'm considering the two-point correlator of the of this scalar field. So I would put the Dirichlet boundary conditions on the scalar field.
You mean a scalar operator.
So I'm computing this two-point correlator for a scalar operator of large conformal dimension, right?
Yes.
So that's where I would put the Dirichlet boundary conditions.
What does it mean?
Sorry.
What does it mean, Dirichlet boundary conditions for an operator?
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit, my ears are plugged from the flight a little bit.
I mean, usually when I hear Dirichlet boundary condition, I think a scalar field,
uh-huh.
A free scalar might have a boundary condition pi equal to zero, or a gauge field,
mm-hmm.
Like boundary condition connection at the boundary equal to zero. But I don't understand what it means, Dirichlet boundary condition for an operator.
Well, just a scalar field. Let's just say a scalar field. Is that, would that work better?
No, it's a bulk. It's a bulk.
This is
a bulk or a boundary?
So the Dirichlet boundary conditions would be in the bulk, but I guess that would correspond to something in the boundary. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let me do a summary and then some of the open questions. So what have we done? We found a setup in which geodesics actually reach near the singularity. They can probe arbitrarily close to large curvature regions. And these are not just, people have found geodesics that do this in the past, but they weren't dual to anything that we could understand in terms of the dual field theory. But in this case, they do. We can understand them in terms of two-point correlator. And this results in horizon scale divergence in the CFT two-point correlator. That is the signature of the singularity. And this pole is in the two-point correlator, in these two-point correlators separated along the p is less than zero direction, whenever the bulk singularity is a genuine curvature singularity, and it's absent when it is not. In momentum space, this corresponds to oscillations in the UV cutoff. Maybe that's something, maybe there's some issue with the field theory because of that. And this pathological behavior doesn't seem likely for, I guess, a weakly coupled field theory, and we might expect that as a result it would. We might expect from this that string theory might resolve the singularity by smoothing out the pole on the dual field theory. So what is there left to do? Well, what is the state of the field theory? I guess, can we use this boundary calculation? Can we, I mean, and again, in higher dimensions, I don't know how this would work. In 1+1 dimensions, it's fairly straightforward, but I don't know how this would work in higher dimensions. And we have to work in higher dimensions, of course. What is the two-point correlator of the weakly coupled field theory? Can we actually solve the Klein-Gordon equation and do this calculation and figure out exactly what is going on in the weakly coupled field theory? Is it the coupling that is responsible? And what are the CFT observables can we use to understand, to see signature of the singularity? It turns out that quantum-dimension two extremal surfaces, which are everyone's favorite bulk probe, is actually useless in this case. You can prove that they bend away from the singularity. All of those surfaces are repulsed from the singularity. And that is all.
There's a huge gap between what you presented and this open problem. Is there some toy model in between that you can draw? Maybe it's too naive, but it seems to me that the key thing is that you should introduce some anisotropy if you want to see some sign of similarity. So
yeah. Is
there some two-point function that one could compute, like when people do this Monte Carlo for this simple ABS CFT developed, or you can do Monte Carlo on the CFT? Is there some toy model that you could ask, that you could propose some computation that you could actually do on the field theory that would you would now claim see a singularity that otherwise you could not see? Because
absolutely. So it's not that the field theory calculation can't be done. You just need to do a very good job of it numerically. The state of the field theory is completely determined by the symmetry that we have, the sort of warp dilation symmetry and the short distance divergence. So in principle, yes, you can numerically solve the Klein-Gordon equations.
Can you explain what do you do on the field theory?
We want a field theory state which lives, you know, the field theory which lives on anisotropic de Sitter, and the state of the field theory has to be such that we get a two-point correlator to diverge at short distances. We have the good short distance divergence, and also that it has the symmetry, the warp dilation symmetry that we have on the space-time. And I think the state should be completely fixed by those two requirements. And so if we can solve the Klein-Gordon equation of the field theory, of the field theory living in this anisotropic de Sitter space, and figure out which state of the field theory corresponds to having both of those requirements satisfied, then that would be the state of the, that would be the calculation we would want to do to compare the field theory calculation with the bulk calculation. So it just, the numerics are very would be very involved, and I personally don't have the skills to do it.
But why would it be a Klein-Gordon equation?
If we're talking about just a scalar field,
a free scalar field, why is it?
A bit strongly coupled,
no? And why is it?
There's a strongly coupled, we've already done the strongly coupled calculation. What we want to do is the weakly coupled calculation at this point to compare with the strongly coupled one and understand how one changes to the other.
But you want to go?
So all we want to do is a weakly coupled calculation. It's just that, unfortunately, the equations are difficult to solve. It's not that in principle it can't be done. It's just that it's hard to solve. It's hard to do it.
Can you explain just one more? So I start with n equals 4, and then what's the second step?
You start with what?
I start with n equals 4 superangulars,
uh-huh.
You said, right?
Yeah.
So now what's the second step?
Yeah, so you start with n equals 4 superangulars on this background I talked about. And so we have we want to solve the Klein-Gordon equation for scalar field because I computed this two-point correlator for scalar field.
What is the scalar field in n equals 4? In n equals 4, I have six scalars, I have a bunch of fields in my Lagrange, and now what do I do?
So let's even go simpler than that. Let's just talk about a free quantum field theory. Forget about conformal invariance even. I mean, at the very basic step is just to take a free quantum field theory living on anisotropic de Sitter. So we have a single scalar field and it's free. And all we want to do at this point is just solve the Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar field and see which solutions are going to give us, which state corresponds to a state which has the short divergence and obeys the symmetry that we need. So that would be step one, and then compute the two-point correlator of this scalar field at these separations and see what happens. Do we actually get a pole in the weakly coupled field theory?
But then I don't think you will be resolving the similarity, because in practice, you are computing the propagator between two points, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which sees this background.
Yes.
Right? So it's the it will in practice be morally speaking the same thing. You will say that there is a background. But what I think you want to see is that the background is emergent, right? And it's not really a classical background, but something quantum that is not really there.
Not on the field theory side. The field theory background is non-dynamical. So it will not change. The bulk background will change. The bulk background is dynamical. The field theory background is not dynamical. So we'll have this anisotropic de Sitter at any coupling.
Strictly speaking, you don't even want to call it a background, no? Don't you want to say that this state is created by having some large operator on the CFT or something? If you want to do it really properly, what does it mean to put n equals 4 on this anisotropic stuff? It means that you acted with some state that generated this anisotropic.
Right? You can put it in here whatever you want, right?
No, you can, but then you will not be, it's like if you put the field theory in a thermal black hole, you are not really probing the quantum. Then it will look like a mixed state and so on, you will not see the. If you want to understand what this state is at the quantum level, I thought you wanted to do something more from first principle. Like, okay, take a Gaussian computer, act with a big operator that creates this background, and then consider a two-point probe.
There is a metric, right, in the boundary, which is not flat.
But then if you do the two-point function on the boundary and on the bulk, it will give the same bisymmetry. No,
the metric on the boundary is CastNet, right?
Yeah.
So she puts an equal four supernumerals on a CastNet background. And
well, and really on a conformal rescaling of CastNet.
Okay, on a CastNet.
Yeah.
Well, but the conformal rescaling, we can always conformal rescale that.
Sure.
Without doing
sure.
Magic tree. And then when we do that, then especially in the cases when you have P
less than zero,
then there is a singularity. And then in the field theory, I don't know how we would do computation. Just from the field theory perspective. How would we compute loops or whatever?
In FA theory, for a calculation, I do the propagator in this metric and then do some interactions.
Well, then it would be the same as field theory near the Big Bang, right? And so there will be no divergences. So it's not, so then the field theory is.
Well, the fact that there are divergences, that there is a conformal transformation between different accounts, doesn't mean that the calculation is completely equivalent to each account.
So what on the field theory are you going to compute? So you put it on the background, and first of all, it's not static background, so
yes.
There will be particle creation.
Yes.
So what exactly are you going to compute on the field theory?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess my point is we don't understand enough, at least the three of us don't understand enough yet about what's going on in the field theory to suggest how a calculation might be done. This is something that is really, I guess, it should have gone under open questions. I think given that there is a two-point correlator, we should be able to compute it, to compute what it looks like in the dual field theory when the field theory is free or weakly coupled. How exactly we're going to go about doing that, that's future work.
So it's basically in n equal 4 supernumeral on a CastNet background, you want to compute two-point correlation function of some gauge invariant operator.
Yes.
Something
yes.
State which deserves any other questions? If not.